Hello and welcome to Asia Stream, where we track, report and analyze the issues and interests of the world's largest region. I am Waj Khan, Nikkei Asia's digital editor here in New York City. Today's episode, and it's a special one, so we're jumping our usual two-week queue, Pakistan's new general manager. Since independence, the Pakistani army, the sixth largest fighting force in the world and the world's only nuclear-armed Islamic military, has earned many titles. It's been called a state within a state, a Praetorian force, a rogue army, even an Islamist threat. In fact, many scholars often describe Pakistan using Voltaire's description of the Prussian military. Most countries have an army, but in this case, the army has a country. The descriptions are well earned. Since independence, the Pakistani army has played an outsized role in the country's political, military, economic, social, and even cultural spheres. Yes, its generals have conducted coups, kicked off wars without approval, suppressed dissent violently, and bred proxy warriors. But you knew that already. After all, this is the military which didn't do a very good job of hiding its supportive relationship with the Taliban, even as it played an ally to the Americans for 20 years. And this is an army which couldn't quite explain what Osama bin Laden was doing, living peacefully near its academy before the US Navy SEALs took him out. Yet, this is a military which has played a pivotal role in global affairs over the past half a century. Its peacekeepers secured nation after nation in Africa in the 1990s. Its pilots helped Arab allies down Israeli jets in the 1960s. Its intelligence officers helped the Americans send the Soviet Union's Red Army packing from Afghanistan in the 1980s. And its generals brokered the most important bilateral relationship in the world today when they played interlocutors in the 1970s for the United States to open up diplomatic relations with China. But this military has Janus's problem of two contradicting faces. It both created the conditions for the onset of a bloody civil war that led to the independent nation of Bangladesh, and since then has held a dysfunctional state like Pakistan together. And in this checkered history, it's fought floods, built roads, battled polio, and tackled crime and terrorism. But at a cost, a very high cost. Political interventionism, eating up the lion's share of the national budget, running an intrusive police state, developing one of the world's fastest growing nuclear programs, and all with almost no accountability. Perhaps those costs are too great to bear for a country that is dead broke and awash with weapons and jihadists, has a very fat youth bulge, and resides in a very rough neighborhood. That's why when there is a change of the guard in the Pakistan army, the world stops to take measure. Who is this new general? What are his intentions? What challenges confront him, and what will he do next to stabilize one of the world's most unstable, even dangerous countries? Strap those boots on. It's time to march. You're listening to The Sound of Asia, streaming in your ear. From Nikkei Asia, this is Asia Stream.
A reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. Get 3 months of our award-winning coverage for just $9. To redeem, just click the link in the episode description.
That's some music from a ceremony held a couple of days ago in a city called Rawalpindi in northeastern Pakistan. But there's nothing remarkable about Rawalpindi, or Pindi as the locals call it. Its overcrowded streets are filled with rickshaws and bicycles and kebab stands. Its shops sell the usual cheap, made-in-China ware found anywhere in urban South Asia. And yet, because Pindi is also the headquarters of the famous or infamous Pakistan Army, and this ceremony marked a change in command within that institution, The hour-long function held there on Tuesday was watched by millions of people on live television, and not just in Pakistan.
Ladies and gentlemen, now the outgoing Chief of Army Staff, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, Nishan-e-Imtiaz Military, will formally hand over the Pakistan Army Command to Chief of Army Staff Designate, General Sayyid Asim Munir, Hilal-e-Imtiaz Military.
The new man in charge of the army is General Sayyid Asim Munir. He's taking over at an interesting time. Pakistan's hyper-polarized right now. Its most popular man, opposition leader, and recently ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan, who just survived an assassination attempt, wants snap elections. Just last week, the local branch of the Taliban declared war on the state, following up with a suicide bombing just this week. The country is still reeling from devastating floods, where about a third of the landmass was underwater and a fifth of the population was washed out of their homes. Economically, the country faces default. And as if all of that weren't enough, the rough neighborhood Pakistan lives in carries on being, well, a rough neighborhood. India is arming itself to the teeth and has recently threatened to attack territories claimed by Pakistan. The Afghan Taliban are ruling over a fast-failing state, triggering a humanitarian disaster, and the Iranians are fighting their own fires of civil unrest and sanctions. Meanwhile, things are tepid with former ally America, lukewarm with current ally China, and barely functional with the Saudis, who can be counted amongst the last patrons of the military and the country. Clearly, Pakistan's seen better days. And we're here to assess the next steps, because if modern history's taught us anything, what happens in Pakistan doesn't stay in Pakistan. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Uzair Yunus, a friend of the pod and the director of the Pakistan Initiative at the Atlantic Council. He will talk to us about the economic crisis that Pakistan faces, a job that General Munir didn't sign up for, but one he will be expected to solve. But first, to discuss the broader context of this army with a country rather than a country with an army, as it usually goes, we have Asia Stream correspondent and the producer of the show, Monica Hunter-Hart, in here in the studio with me. Hi, Monica.
Hello. So I actually want to flip the script a little bit today.
Oh, no. Okay.
Well, normally we sit here and you ask me questions as we catch listeners up on the basics of whatever topic we're discussing that day. But that really doesn't feel appropriate today because this is your area of expertise. Pakistan, of course, but even more specifically, the Pakistan Army. You've been embedded with like almost 100 of their units, I think. You've done some crazy frontline stuff with them. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like you know these guys better than anyone.
It's a poison chalice. But you flatter me, Monica. Thank you.
Well, basically, I'm hoping to actually ask you the questions today. And I do have quite a few of them. Does that sound okay?
I didn't sign up for this, but nor did General Asim Munir. So yeah, sure. Go for it. Let's do this.
All right. So first of all, I just want to understand why this is the story that everyone is talking about right now. Almost every country has an army, and every army has a chief or a general. So what is such a big deal here?
Right. The big deal here is the army itself, right? So this is not a typical army. Typical armies, either fight wars once in a generation or once every 5 years if you're Russia, right? But once in a generation or two, you'll fight a war. Maybe there'll be a skirmish if you're in a rough neighborhood. Usually train most of the time. You know, come to schools, maybe recruit some people, do push-ups and jump off planes the rest of the time. This is what most armies do, right? In this army's case, this is a mega superstructure. This is not a mere military, right? Besides doing all of the things any other military does, this military is also the largest business conglomerate of the country. It builds roads. It holds bicycle races. It selects the cricket team. It makes movies. Yeah, it makes TV dramas. It's got a super, super duper presence in pretty much every aspect of national life. But besides that, besides the social bits or the economic bits, it also drives policy. The army chief is also the de facto foreign minister. In fact, the last army chief, and I did a story on him for Nikkei a few months ago. It's one of our best read stories this year. I'm very proud of it. The army chief was also the finance minister, sort of calling up American officials in the summer when Pakistan was facing default, asking for the U.S. to bail Pakistan out by giving the IMF the green light. So in a way, this is not just some guy who's gotten here after, you know, doing a few command courses and riding a few tanks and running it out in his early days. Sure, yeah, the typical stuff remains, but there's a larger aspect here about foreign policy, economic policy, social policy, national policy.
I have to ask, are the movies that it produces any good?
Oh, they're horrible. They're actually pretty bad. I mean, some of them are good, but listen, I mean, every state does propaganda. You know, Putin's doing his own thing, even despite the fact that he's losing this war. But listen, just the very fact that this music we were showing and the pomp we were showing from the ceremony earlier in the episode. Now, this ceremony was one general literally giving a stick to another general, you know, and they used to do this, you know, back in the day, they used to do this in an office and somebody would take a photograph and nobody would really see it. But the very fact that they've started making this a parade, they've started in the last decade or so showing this on national television, it gets more and more elaborate every time. There's song, there's dance, there's announcements. People are it's like the Super Bowl, except it's a couple of old dudes in uniform and people from New Delhi to New York are interested because the stakes are high. And the army knows that. It makes sure that its outsized presence is projected. The fact that they've literally taken this ceremony and made it out of nothing adds to their machine. Their propaganda arm has done a remarkable job. Being someone who's reported on the army extensively, I can guarantee you they've got a very sophisticated propaganda arm, but these days it's in serious trouble because of the one and only Imran Khan, whom I hope we talk about later in the show.
So I'm really struck by something that I was reading, which is that as far as Pakistan's prime ministers go, not one of them in the entire 75-year history of the country has actually completed a full term. Of course, the most recent example of that was Imran Khan being, you know, pushed out in April. And then on the other side of this, we actually have 16 army chiefs of Pakistan since the founding, and only one of them has resigned voluntarily. So I just want to be super clear here. General Bajwa, the outgoing chief, has left voluntarily, right?
He has, and the numbers don't make sense. So prime ministers are elected for 5 years, right? And the very fact that this number doesn't make sense, there's been 23 guys and gals, one gal, 22 guys, who have not completed their term, right? Versus 16 dudes, all guys, who have either completed their term. Makes no sense over a period of 75 years. The math is wrong, and the math is wrong because it's political. Because generals tend to stay on over the 3 years, sometimes well over the 3 years. Most of them have outlasted their welcome. Four of them have ruled by decree, emergency, or martial law. It's become fashionable for them to get extensions, multi-year extensions. These are supposed to be constitutional. Right now, I'm using the quotation marks with my fingers for those who cannot see me. But General Bajwa was 3 years past his official welcome, his official tenure. And that added that propensity to just stay on in power longer complicates not just the constitutional gap and disparity with the government in power, but also within the army. So here's one guy, he takes over as a general, yet during his tenure, he's not seen one, not two, not three, but four prime ministers. So the fact that even in this last 6 years when General Bajwa was around, Pakistan has had one army chief and four prime ministers, Nawaz Sharif, kicked out. Imran Khan, kicked out. In the middle, there was this guy called Shahid Khaqan Abbasi, sort of caretaking after Nawaz Sharif, seen off. And then, of course, currently Shehbaz Sharif, Nawaz Sharif's younger brother. The fact that one army chief has lasted as long as four prime ministers says that there's something wrong in the political math of the way civil-military relations balance out. Yeah.
Truly, yeah. So we've now brought up Imran Khan lots of times. So let's just talk about him for a minute. As I understand it, there's some definite friction between him and this new chief, Munir. At the end of 2018, Munir became the head of Pakistan's top intelligence agency, but Khan quickly removed him from power. It was only 8 months later. Some say that that was maybe one of the earliest signs that Khan was beginning to break with the military. And he definitely did break with the military during his time in power and also since. He seems to have kind of changed the game when it came to the public's relationship with the army. He's been criticizing them, confronting them, and I guess has sort of made it okay to do that, if that's right. How is that going to affect Pakistan in the long run? And is that kind of more confrontational attitude going to be any kind of a challenge for Munir?
Right. So, okay. So first of all, Imran Khan is, he couldn't have gotten to the premiership without the army's blessings. But that's pretty much true for anyone who's ever led the country, right? Before Khan, the prime minister before Khan was Nawaz Sharif. Nawaz Sharif was in the 1980s and 90s groomed by the military to become the man he is today. He eventually broke away with them, just like Khan has broken off with them. Before Sharif, it was the era of the Bhuttos and Benazir Bhutto's father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. He was actually a foreign minister in dictator's cabinet in the 1950s. Khan is just the latest one in a series of them. But Khan's different because had they done their profiling on him, and he was in his time one of the world's most aggressive cricketers, and obviously if we're talking about Pakistani politics, we've got to bring the great game in. If they knew what this guy was about, he's more dangerous outside than he is inside. So while other prime ministers have been sent off packing with their tail between their legs or been executed like the Bhuttos, like Zulfikar Bhutto was, or jailed, or fined, or tried, Khan is on the loose and is also proving to be a liability. And he has, through his protest movement, which has been ongoing for a better part of this year, he's really turned the tables on these guys. Like, what Khan has done in the last few months, no single politician, activist, protester, writer, poet, filmmaker, revolutionary, dissenter has done in 75 years, collectively speaking. Imran Khan has made it okay for you to go on Twitter today and say whatever you want to say about the army, including four-letter words, and tweet it away and make it go viral. He's made it okay for you to go to any one of his rallies, and there's multiple ones going on any given day in Pakistan, and write anything you want on a placard or on your T-shirt or on your flag about the army and put it up. So he's made it okay for the army to be called not so okay. And that hasn't happened in a while. Now, he's paid a price for it. Just a few weeks ago, he survived an assassination attempt. He blamed, literally blamed, not just the prime minister, you know, affording it, but also generals within the army. He named people in particular. So he's on a warpath with these guys. Now, the very fact that you mentioned this new chap, General Munir, the details of his relationship with Khan, yes, they had a few months together. He was Khan's first intelligence chief. It was Khan's first few months in office when they met each other. The reports are hazy, but this is what we know. Khan wanted a loyalist in office. Him sacking Munir, the new chief, has less to do, I think, than his problems with Munir, and more to do with him having a man crush on his loyalist, Faiz Hamid, who, by the way, has now been forced out by General Asim Munir in one of the first moves he's made. So he's pushing Imran loyalists out of uniform.
So much drama.
It's a lot of drama. It's a lot of drama. This is like a South Asian Game of Thrones. Like, and it's on.
It really sounds like that, yeah. So I don't want to go into too much depth here because I want to bring on Uzair pretty soon. But just can you just tell us a little bit more about Munir himself? I'm just curious, is this like meet the new boss, same as the old boss kind of situation? Or is he really going to shake things up maybe?
You know, the profiling has been interesting about him. The Indians watch the Pakistani military like New Jersey watches New York, right? With disdain, right? And keen interest. But the idea is one thing which has been going around is the fact that General Munir is a scholar of the Quran. He's a Hafiz of Quran.
That means he can
shoot off any para, verse, or word at a, you know, he's memorized it. Some folks in the Western press as well think that is a sign of his fundamentalism. But the military is pretty good at weeding out the crazies, especially at this level. The fact that the last four jobs he had before this one, over the last decade, were all pretty important to one degree or the other. He's the first general to have held leadership positions in two of the country's most important spy agencies, military intelligence as well as the ISI. Mm-hmm. In a place like Pakistan, being spy master of not just one, but two agencies is a pretty big deal, considering this is an agency state. This is an intelligence-run police state. So the fact that he ran the MI as well as the ISI, then the fact that his last few years on the ground have been focused on military formations, which are really on the radar right now. He's commanded an area where Indian troops are facing off with Chinese troops, even as we record this podcast, in the heights of the Karakoram and the Himalayas, the Force Command Northern Areas Division, which is the highest battlefield in the world. It's where the Pakistani, the Chinese, and the Indian militaries are all eyeball to eyeball with each other. He was in charge there. And then he had a pretty cushy post in Gujranwala, as co-command of the 30th Corps, but even that is an India-centric formation. So he's had his eyes on India for the last several years, but his eyes on the dark arts as well for the last few years. So
That being spying,
yeah. So premised on his experience with India and the dark arts, the fact that he was the ISI chief during the negotiations between the Americans and the Taliban, right before the US pullout, mm-hmm. also says something. So he was the guy who oversaw the deal. And Pakistan, as you know, played a pivotal role in the deal that allowed, well, the Americans to walk out with some degree of their heads held high. I mean, we did see that massacre in the last days of the pullout and that debacle near Kabul airport. But more or less, the Taliban declared a very long ceasefire, letting the Americans pull out. Not one American soldier, marine, airman, sailor was killed in the last days of the Afghan war by Taliban hands. The IS did attack the US, but that's a different story. He saw that peace deal be executed. So again, not someone we should take lightly, either in Washington, which knows him well, or in Delhi, which also knows him well. As far as his political activities are concerned, that's also part of his job. Whether you like it or not, the Pakistani army chief is also the reason I called him the general manager.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, the reason I've titled this episode General Manager is it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but that's what you sign up for. You are the governor general of sorts. In a country where civilian institutions have not been allowed by hook or by crook, by default or by design, to, well, excel, where there's vacuums across pretty much every strata of governance, the army comes across as the most organized organization. As it's not just the most powerful organization because it can fire guns, but it can fight, it can battle COVID, it battles polio. When the police fails, the army steps in to clean up street crime. etc. So the politics of it all and the governance of it all is also a part of his ambit. He's come in at a very messy time. Imran Khan is on the rise. He's demanding snap elections. The army's facing serious pushback from the streets of Pakistan. Regular Pakistanis, especially millennials and Gen Zers, don't have that level of respect for this regime. It's very similar to what's happening in Iran, except in Iran, it's happening against the Ayatollah. In Pakistan, it's the angst is developing against the army. But the Ayatollah was never very popular. The army has, till recently, been very popular. So he needs to win that popularity back. He needs to get his own house in order. He needs to confront Imran Khan, and that is a tall order. But the biggest challenge, and I don't know if he's qualified for this, is that the country is facing economic default. We're back on the brink. I know Uzair is going to talk about the dollars and cents of it, but Pakistan is facing a serious economic crisis. The military is not meant to tackle that, but what it can do is provide stability, steer Pakistan towards stability. And one can see so far that he keeps his head down. He's not a brash, swaggery character. There have been some quite a lot of characters in office. They're watched very keenly, but he's supposed to be a sober, straight-shooting, quiet man. And I'm hoping that the stability the country needs can be provided by this infantryman from the 23rd Frontier Force Regiment, which I have been embedded with, by the way.
All right, Wat Khan, thank you for being a guest on Asia Stream.
Good to be here.
No, I'm just kidding. Thank you for being in the hot seat. We appreciate it. That was an excellent primer. I think I am going to kick you out now and bring on Uzair Yunus.
I thought this was my show.
Not today.
All right. Thank you for having me. Thanks for flipping the script. And I'll see you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks. We now have the great pleasure to welcome back to the pod Uzair Yunus. He is the director of the Pakistan Initiative at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center in Washington, D.C., and he is the host of the Pakistanomy podcast. Uzair, we are so happy to have you back, and I'm hoping you can just start off by helping get us situated. I'm sure that many listeners are still wrapping their heads around the idea of the military playing such a large role in Pakistan's politics, so I'm hoping you can help us understand a little bit more. Exactly how much control does the army chief have over economic matters?
Well, see, it's grown a lot over the last few years, particularly over the last 6 years of General Bajwa, who just retired as the Chief of Army Staff. In the very early months, even of him becoming chief, he started talking about things like Pakistan has too much foreign debt. Started meeting business leaders, starting addressing business leaders at chambers of commerce in Karachi and Lahore, the two big economic centers of the country. And so through that, in the very early days of him being the chief of the army, that role began to grow. Now, of course, Pakistan's military has been dominant in the economy for decades before General Bajwa became the chief of army staff. It operates everything from cereal manufacturing companies to banks and infrastructure providers as well. So over the last 6 years, a lot of that has grown tremendously, not only because the chief took such an interest or the business leaders went to him to talk about problems they were facing in terms of governance, but also because Imran Khan's government, when it came into power in 2018, ceded much of that space. So for example, you heard in conversations in Islamabad that even tax policy matters got input from the military, and the military was providing that input because business leaders are going to the chief, not to the finance minister. So that's how protracted the challenge has become over the last few years.
Got it. So what are the economic problems facing Pakistan right now that the army chief will be expected to help solve?
Well, see, there are three broad challenges and they're feeding off of each other. So it's not like they're in isolation with one another. The first one, obviously, is the fact that Pakistan barely has 5 weeks of foreign reserves left. And it has, in the first week of December, $1 billion of bond payments coming due. Half a billion, in addition, has been received from the Asian Infrastructure Bank, AIIB. IIIB. So basically the delta there is a negative $500 million at this point in time. Obviously, Pakistan depends on the largesse of its key allies, among them China and Saudi Arabia being the largest ones. And over the years, the chief of army staff, not just General Bajwa, but his predecessors as well, have gone to Saudi Arabia or have engaged with the Chinese to hash out certain issues or to give certain guarantees, etc. So that's one crisis where a new army chief, even though they're talking about being apolitical, there will be this institutional expectation that, hey, you gotta engage with these countries to get the reserves back up. So that's one crisis. The second crisis is the inflationary crisis. It's linked to a weakening rupee, which is being fed off of the declining reserves, but there are other issues as well in the domestic economy that have fueled inflation. That crisis impacts the army chief because this is one of the world's largest armies, 600,000 soldiers, right? So all of a sudden, if inflation is 26% year on year, you as one of the largest employers in the country will have pressure institutionally to say, hey, boss, our soldiers are not too happy because their real incomes are declining. Inflation is 26%. You got to give them a pay hike. Obviously, that is a political choice. The finance minister has to give pay hikes. So that's a second area where he will feel pressure and the need to get involved or the need to have a say in economic matters. The third, linked to salaries, linked to tax policy, et cetera, is the broader fiscal deficit. Pakistan has been running super high fiscal deficits for a number of months now. The IMF is not happy about it. They're saying you got to raise taxes, cut spending. One way to raise taxes, for example, is to impose, and many people, including myself, have been arguing for this for years, is to have a real estate tax, a meaningful real estate tax. And over here, I'll just give a tidbit of data for your listeners that the city of Pune in India, which is a large city, but not the largest city in India, raises more in real estate taxes than the entire province of Sindh in Pakistan. That's how distorted the tax market on the real estate side is. But again, that draws in the military because the military operates these housing societies called DHAs, Defense Housing Associations. There are a number of them across the country. Generals own that land. They make a lot of money off of that land, even when they get allocated that land, etc. So all of a sudden, if a finance minister tomorrow takes my recommendation on board and says we're going to tax real estate so that we don't have this kind of a distortion in the market, well, the military will get involved once more.
I want to go back to the first problem you mentioned. So during the 6 years that the outgoing army chief, General Bajwa, was in power, he emphasized diplomacy. He traveled all over the world building relationships. He spent a lot of energy maintaining Pakistan's alliances with China and Saudi Arabia, which you've touched on. And those relationships are more important than ever now, given this shortage of foreign reserves, because Pakistan really needs deposits from China and Saudi to boost them. So does that dire need for foreign reserves mean that the incoming General Munir will be forced to use the same diplomatic playbook as Bajwa? How do you think this reserves crisis will impact foreign policy under Munir?
I think this will be an interesting moment to watch, right? Because on one hand, you have the military leadership saying we want to go back into the barracks, so to speak, or be apolitical in terms of the language they've used. But as we talked about, there are crises that will draw them in. And on the diplomatic side, whether it's the Chinese or the Saudis or even the Emiratis and the Qataris, they have had this long period of time going back as far back as Kayani, who was the chief right after the dictatorship of General Musharraf was over in 2007-08, that they feel the army as an institution has a more long-term view and they're more reliable as actors. When they give certain guarantees, they get acted upon. So again, there will be this probably expectation in foreign capitals in China and Saudi Arabia and UAE in particular that, you know, we got to engage with the new chief because that's who is going to be in charge for the next 3 years, maybe longer than that if he gets an extension. We don't know where the civilians will be even 6 months from now. So that expectation is on the external side, likely to draw them in once again or draw General Munir in once again. The other issue over here is that over the years, you've seen the civilians sort of outsource domestically this kind of diplomacy to the military itself. So, for example, in the Imran Khan years, General Bajwa went to China when there were issues around CPEC. Khan's minister said something the Chinese did not like. He was firefighting that. The foreign minister, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, in that era said something about the Saudis that the Saudis didn't like. And General Bajwa was back in Saudi Arabia to sort of smooth over those differences. So that outsourcing is also going to be a problem on the civilian side. Now, whether they want to take that back or are capable of it remains to be seen as well. So I think both those challenges are there, and there will be this expectation for a new chief as well to say, hey, you know what, the military is suffering reputationally given the way General Bajwa left things. We need to rebuild our reputation. Maybe some advisors will tell General Munir, hey boss, if you go to Saudi Arabia or to China and bring a few billion dollars back, that will help us position you as sort of the savior of Pakistan. So that temptation also might creep in. It's too early to say how this will play out. But again, these are some of the scenarios that might play out in the coming months.
And can you explain how the pressure of inflation, and inflation in Pakistan is among the highest in South Asia, may impact the next few months to a year for Munir?
Yeah, so look, over here, again, if you go back to January 2019, I've been collecting this data since then. Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, if you compare the three countries in the subcontinent, Bangladesh and India since 2019 have had inflation of roughly 25%, give or take a few percentage points. Pakistan has had 65%, so more than 2x the rate of inflation in the other two countries. That basically means that for the last 3 years or so, ordinary Pakistani citizens have lost a lot of purchasing power because of sky-high inflation. 600,000 soldiers, as I mentioned earlier, in the Pakistan Army. Many of them are not the elite generals with access to DHA plots and privileges and perks like that, right? So they're also suffering, much like the ordinary laborer in a bazaar in Pakistan is suffering. So that inflation crisis now will mean that the new general will feel pressure internally to give them a pay hike. But also, what are you doing about the economy, especially when there's this perception that the military brought the current government into power because they were done and fed up with Imran Khan. So I think that will draw him in again. And if inflation does not ease, again, in the early months, General Munir might say, I want a low profile. This is none of our business. Let's go back. But the longer this economic crisis persists, the higher inflation keeps going, the more pushback and the more pressure he will face in terms of wanting to do something about it, because 600,000 soldiers will be agitating, saying either you give us a very high pay hike, well, you can't because the economic situation is dire, or you do something to fix governance and fix inflation in this economy.
Pakistan is scheduled to have its next general election about a year from now in October, but Imran Khan might force them to happen earlier, maybe even this spring. Now, as you've said several times, the military is claiming to be an apolitical force, but is it actually possible for the military to really be apolitical in the run-up to this next election? And what are some scenarios for how General Munir's appointment might affect the election?
Yeah, so I think currently this appointment is a blow to Imran Khan, because his entire campaign in the last few months was to prevent this outcome. General Munir fell out of favor with Imran Khan. He had one of the shortest stints as DG of the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency. Even in conversations, private conversations with PTI leaders, they would say in so many words that General Munir was not going to be their favorite among the lot that was up for promotion. But now he is the chief of army staff. So on the government side, they're kind of saying, well, we kind of got the guy who Imran Khan does not like. He's not going to play ball with him. Again, too early to tell how the chief acts, right? So there's a perception, and reality can be often very different. And this actually has been the experience of the ruling party in the coalition, the PMLN. They've picked numerous army chiefs and have had a fallout with all of them. So whether this is an exception, we don't know yet. And so I think it remains to be seen. But again, the longer the economic crisis goes on, the more people will start paying attention to Imran Khan's logic, who's been arguing that the only way out of this instability, economic and political, are elections. And they've been asking in so many ways for the military to play its role, unconstitutional role, by the way, they don't deny that, unconstitutional role to force early elections, to get the government to accede to the demands of the PTI. And again, General Munir might be able to resist that urge for the first 2, 3, 4 months. But if things start going south or keep going south, he may face pressure to say, hey, you know what, time out, everybody. Let's force you to sit around a table and hash out an election schedule ahead of time.
Under the term of outgoing General Bajwa, the military only became more involved in Pakistan's politics, arguably destabilizing the country further. Is there a feasible scenario in which the power of the military decreases in comparison to the civilian government anytime soon? What would allow that to happen, and could it happen under General Munir?
I think this is entirely possible. There is a great example in East Asia, Indonesia, that made that choice. And after the Asian financial crisis, Suharto stepped down and there was a plan and it was executed upon consistently, right? These things don't happen overnight. So it's not like today there's a lot of influence of the military in the economy. Tomorrow it's going to go down to zero. It takes two to tango in this dance as well. So on the one hand, yes, you will have to have a chief that is okay with, you know, stepping back, even when leaving a vacuum causes more instability in the near term, because you got to let the process play out. So on the one hand, he has to be careful not to sort of intervene again when things start going south, or the acceleration of things going south picks up. And then on the other, the civilians actually have to govern better and push the reforms or do the necessary things that, you know, put the economy back on a sound trajectory, on a sound footing moving forward. I think it will take a lot of time, and it's not an extremely likely scenario that all of this plays out the way it played out in Indonesia, primarily because in the Indonesian case, the military itself put out a plan that says, here's how we're going to step by step do this. Pakistan's military has not done that yet, at least not that we know of. And so we will see where this goes. But it's not totally impossible to do that, right? I think the first step for this has to be, for example, the culture of having retired or serving military personnel serve in government institutions, in the economy, in the power sector, etc. That has to stop. That's step number one in my book. Then, for example, the chief or the sector commanders or the people in the ISI should stop meeting people in the Chamber of Commerce or business leaders. Those meetings, none of the business of the military to have those meetings, right? Providing input on things like technology policy or tax policy should stop. If we start seeing some of these small steps, incremental steps, then one can build confidence and say, okay, over the next 3 years, this can be sustained. And then maybe another chief comes in and he sustains this as well. But at this point in time, we have had no inclination or no indication, except the pronouncements by the military saying we're apolitical. Well, we're not seeing that in action yet.
Uzair Yunus, thank you so much for coming back on Asia Stream.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for Asia Stream this week. As always, we are very grateful that you listen to our coverage, but we also highly encourage you to read it. There is so much out there that we don't have time to cover on the pod. So head to Nikkei Asia at asia.nikkei.com, both for more coverage of Pakistani politics, but also all things related to Asia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share, subscribe, and leave us a review. And a last reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. To get the discount, just click the link in the episode description. This episode was hosted by Waj Khan, and I am your lead producer and correspondent, Monica Hunter-Hart. We'll stream again in 2 weeks. In the meantime, we'll watch the early days of Munir's tenure play out. Will the military and civilian government begin to repair their relationship and work together more congenially? Let's hope so. After all, teamwork makes the stream work.